old man. As the short convict had testified, the tall one, when he returned to the surface, still retained what the short one called the oar. He clung to it, not instinctively against the time when he would be back inside the boat and would need it, because, for a time, he did not believe he would ever regain the skiff or anything else that would support him, but because he did not have time to think about turning it loose. Things had moved too fast for him. He had not been warned. He had felt the first snatching tug of the current. He had seen the skiff begin to spin, and his companion vanish violently upward, like in a translation out of Isaiah. Then he himself was in the water, struggling against the drag of the paddle, which he did not know he still held each time he fought back to the surface and grasped at the spinning skiff, which at one instant was 10 feet away, and the next poised above his head as though about to brain him, until at last he grasped the stern, the drag of his body becoming a rudder to the skiff, the two of them, man and boat, and with the paddle perpendicular above them like a jackstaff, vanishing from the view of the short convict, who had vanished from that of the tall one with the same celerity, though in a vertical direction, like a tableau snatched off stage intact with violent and incredible speed. He was now in the channel of a slough, a bayou, in which until today no current had run, probably since the old subterranean outrage which had created the country. There was plenty of current in it now, though. From his trough behind the stern, he seemed to see the trees and sky rushing past with vertiginous speed. Looking down at him between the gouts of cold yellow in lugubrious and mournful amazement. But they were fixed and secure in something. He thought of that. He remembered in an instant of despairing rage the firm earth, fixed and founded, strong and cemented, fast and stable forever, by the generations of laborious sweat somewhere beneath him, beyond the reach of his feet. When, and again without warning, the stern of the skiff struck him a stunning blow across the bridge of his nose. The instinct which had caused him to cling to it now caused him to fling the paddle into the boat in order to grasp the gunwale with both hands just as the skiff pivoted and spun away again. With both hands free, he now dragged himself over the stern and lay prone on his face, streaming with blood and water, and panting, not with exhaustion, but with that furious rage which is terror's aftermath. But he had to get up at once because he believed he had come much faster, and so further than he had. So he rose, out of the watery scarlet puddle in which he had lain, streaming, the soaked denim heavy as iron on his limbs, the black hair plastered to his skull, the blood-infused water streaking his jumper, and dragged his forearm gingerly and hurriedly across his lower face and glanced at it, then grasped the paddle and began to try to swing the skiff back upstream. It did not even occur to him that he did not know where his companion was, in which tree among all which he had passed or might pass. He did not even speculate on that, for the reason that he knew so incontestably that the other was upstream from him, and after his recent experience, the mere connotation of the term upstream carried a sense of such violence and force and speed that the conception of it as other than a straight line was something which the intelligence, reason, simply refused to harbor, like the notion of a rifle bullet the width of a cotton field. The bow began to swing back upstream. It turned readily. It outpaced the aghast and outraged instant in which he realized it was swinging far too easily. It had swung on over the arc and lay broadside to the current, and began again that vicious spinning while he sat, his teeth bared in his bloody, streaming face, while his spent arms flailed the impotent paddle at the water. That innocent-appearing medium which at one time had held him in iron-like and shifting convolutions, like an anaconda, yet which now seemed to offer no more resistance to the thrust of his urge and need than so much air. Like air. The boat which had threatened him and at last actually struck him in the face with the shocking violence of a mule's hoof now seemed to poise weightless upon it like a thistle bloom, spinning like a wind vane while he flailed at the water and thought of, envisioned his companion safe, inactive, and at ease in the tree, with nothing to do but wait, musing with impotent and terrified fury upon that arbitrariness of human affairs which had abrogated to the one the secure tree and to the other the hysterical and unmanageable boat, for the very reason that it knew that he alone of the two of them would make any attempt to return and rescue his companion. The skiff had paid off and now ran with the current again. It seemed again to spring from immobility into incredible speed, and he thought he must already be miles away from where his companion had quitted him, though actually he had merely described a big circle, since getting back into the skiff and the object, a clump of cypress trees choked by floating logs and debris, which the skiff was now about to strike, was the same one it had careened into before when the stern had struck him. He didn't know this because he had not yet ever looked higher than the bow of the boat. He didn't look higher now. He just saw that he was going to strike. He seemed to feel run through the very insentient fabric of the skiff a current of eager, gleeful, vicious, incorrigible willfulness. And he who had never ceased to flail at the bland, treacherous water with what he had believed to be the limit of his strength, now, from somewhere, some ultimate, absolute reserve, produced a final measure of endurance, will to endure which adumbrated mere muscle and nerves, continuing to flail the paddle right up to the instant of striking, completing one last reach thrust and recover out of pure, desperate reflex, as a man slipping on ice reaches for his hat and money pocket. As the skiff struck and hurled him once more flat on his face in the bottom of it. This time he did not get up at once. He lay flat on his face, slightly spread-eagled and in an attitude almost peaceful, a kind of abject meditation. He would have to get up sometime, he knew that, just as all life consists of having to get up sooner or later, and then having to lie down again sooner or later after a while. And he was not exactly exhausted, and he was not particularly without hope, and he did not especially dread getting up. It merely seemed to him that he had accidentally been caught in a situation in which time and environment, not himself, was mesmerized. He was being toyed with by a current of water going nowhere, beneath a day which would wane toward no evening. When it was done with him, it would spew him back into the comparatively safe world he had been snatched violently out of, and in the meantime it did not much matter just what he did or did not do. So he lay on his face, now not only feeling but hearing the strong, quiet rustling of the current on the underside of the planks for a while longer. Then he raised his head and this time touched his palm gingerly to his face and looked at the blood again. Then he sat up onto his heels, and, leaning over the gunwale, he pinched his nostrils between thumb and finger and expelled a gout of blood, and was in the act of wiping his fingers on his thigh when a voice slightly above his line of sight said quietly, "It taken you a while." And he who up to this moment had had neither reason nor time to raise his eyes higher than the boughs, looked up, and saw, sitting in a tree and looking at him, a woman. She was not 10 feet away. She sat on the lowest limb of one of the trees, holding the jam he had grounded on, in a calico wrapper, and an army private's tunic, and a sunbonnet. A woman whom he did not even bother to examine, since that first startled glance had been ample to reveal to him all the generations of her life and background, who could have been his sister if he had a sister. His wife, if he had not entered the penitentiary at an age scarcely out of adolescence, and some years younger than that at which even his prolific and monogamous kind married. A woman who sat clutching the trunk of the tree, her stockingless feet in a pair of man's unlaced brogans less than a yard from the water, who was very probably somebody's sister, and quite certainly, or certainly should have been, somebody's wife. Though this, too, he had entered the penitentiary too young to have had more than mere theoretical female experience to discover yet.
"I thought for a minute you wasn't aiming to come back."
"Come back?"
"After the first time. After you run into this brush pile the first time and got into the boat and went on."
He looked about, touching his face tenderly again. It could very well be the same place where the boat had hit him in the face.
"Yeah," he said. "I'm here now, though. Could you maybe get the boat a little closer? I taken a right sharp strain getting up here. Maybe I better..."
He was not listening. He had just discovered that the paddle was gone. This time, when the skiff hurled him forward, he had flung the paddle not into it, but beyond it.
"It's right there in them brush tops," the woman said. "You can get it. Here, catch a holt of this."
It was a grapevine. It had grown up into the tree, and the flood had torn the roots loose. She had taken a turn with it about her upper body. She now loosed it and swung it out until he could grasp it. Holding to the end of the vine, he warped the skiff around the end of the jam, picking up the paddle, and warped the skiff on beneath the limb, and held it, and now he watched her move, gather herself heavily and carefully to descend. That heaviness which was not painful, but just excruciatingly careful, that profound and almost lethargic awkwardness, which added nothing to the sum of that first aghast amazement, which had served already for the catafalque of invincible dream, since even endurance he had continued, and even with the old avidity, even though they had caused his downfall, to consume the impossible pulp-printed fables carefully censored and as carefully smuggled into the penitentiary. And who to say what Helen, what living Garbo, he had not dreamed of rescuing from what craggy pinnacle or dragoned keep when he and his companion embarked in the skiff. He watched her. He made no further effort to help her beyond holding the skiff savagely steady while she lowered herself from the limb. The entire body, the deformed swell of belly bulging the calico, suspended by its arms, thinking, "And this is what I get. This, out of all the female meat that walks, is what I have to be caught in a runaway boat with." "Where's that cotton house?" he said.
"Cotton house?
With that fellow on it, the other one."
"I don't know. It's a right smart of cotton houses around here. With folks on them, too, I reckon."
She was examining him.
"You're bloody as a hog," she said. "You look like a convict."
"Yeah," he said, snarled. "I feel like I done already been hung. Well, I gotta pick up my partner and then find that cotton house." He cast off. That is, he released his hold on the vine. That was all he had to do, for even while the bow of the skiff hung high on the log jam, and even while he held it by the vine in the comparatively dead water behind the jam, he felt steadily and constantly the whisper, the strong, purring power of the water, just 1 inch beyond the frail planks on which he squatted, and which, as soon as he released the vine, took charge of the skiff, not with one powerful clutch, but in a series of touches, light, tentative, and cat-like. He realized now that he had entertained a sort of foundationless hope that the added weight might make the skiff more controllable. During the first moment or two, he had a wild and still foundationless belief that it had. He had got the head upstream and managed to hold it so by terrific exertion, continued even after he discovered that they were traveling straight enough but stern first, and continued somehow even after the bow began to wear away and swing. The old irresistible movement which he knew well by now, too well to fight against it, so that he let the bow swing on downstream, with the hope of utilizing the skiff's own momentum to bring it through the full circle, and so upstream again. The skiff traveling broadside, then bow first, then broadside again, diagonally across the channel, toward the other wall of submerged trees. It began to flee beneath him with terrific speed. They were in an eddy, but did not know it. He had no time to draw conclusions or even wonder. He crouched, his teeth bared in his blood-caked and swollen face, his lungs bursting, flailing at the water while the trees stooped hugely down at him. The skiff struck, spun, struck again. The woman half lay in the bow, clutching the gunwales, as if she were trying to crouch behind her own pregnancy. He banged now not at the water, but at the living, sap-blooded wood with the paddle, his desire now not to go anywhere, reach any destination, but just to keep the skiff from beating itself to fragments against the tree trunks. Then something exploded, this time against the back of his head, and stooping trees and dizzy water, the woman's face and all, fled together and vanished in bright, soundless flash and glare. An hour later, the skiff came slowly up an old logging road and so out of the bottom, the forest, and into, or onto, a cotton field, a gray and limitless desolation now free of turmoil, broken only by a thin line of telephone poles, like a wading millipede. The woman was now paddling, steadily and deliberately, with that curious lethargic care, while the convict squatted, his head between his knees, trying to stanch the fresh and apparently inexhaustible flow of blood from his nose with hands full of water. The woman ceased paddling. The skiff drifted on, slowing, while she looked about. "We're done out," she said. The convict raised his head and also looked about. "Out where?" "I thought maybe you might know." "I don't even know where I used to be. Even if I knowed which way was north, I wouldn't know if that was where I wanted to go." He cupped another handful of water to his face and lowered his hand and regarded the resulting crimson marbling on his palm, not with dejection, not with concern, but with a kind of sardonic and vicious bemusement. The woman watched the back of his head. "We gotta get somewhere." "Don't I know it? A fellow on a cotton house, another in a tree, and now that thing in your lap." "It wasn't due yet. Maybe it was having to climb that tree quick yesterday and having to set in it all night. I'm doing the best I can, but we better get somewhere soon." "Yeah," the convict said. "I thought I wanted to get somewhere, too, and I ain't had no luck at it. You pick out a place to get to now, and we'll try yours. Give me that oar." The woman passed him the paddle. The boat was a double-ender. He had only to turn around. "Which way you fixing to go?" the woman said. "Never you mind that. You just keep on holding on." He began to paddle on across the cotton field. It began to rain again, though not hard at first. "Yeah," he said. "Ask the boat. I've been in it since breakfast, and I ain't never knowed where I aimed to go or where I was going either." That was about 1 o'clock. Toward the end of the afternoon, the skiff, they were in a channel of some sort again. They had been in it for some time. They had got into it before they knew it, and too late to get out again. Granted, there had been any reason to get out, to the convict anyway. There was certainly none, and the fact that their speed had increased again was reason enough to stay in it. Shot out upon a broad expanse of debris-filled water, which the convict recognized as a river, and, from its size, the Yazoo River, though it was little enough he had seen of this country which he had not quitted for so much as one single day in the last 7 years of his life. What he did not know was that it was now running backward. So as soon as the drift of the skiff indicated the set of the current, he began to paddle in that direction which he believed to be downstream, where he knew there were towns, Yazoo City, and, as a last resort, Vicksburg, if his luck was that bad. If not, smaller towns whose names he did not know, but where there would be people, houses, something, anything he might reach and surrender his charge to and turn his back on her forever, on all pregnant and female life forever, and return to that monastic existence of shotguns and shackles where he would be secure from it. Now, with the imminence of habitations, release from her, he did not even hate her. When he looked upon the swelling and unmanageable body before him, it seemed to him that it was not the woman at all, but rather a separate, demanding, threatening, inert, yet living mass, of which both he and she were equally victims. Thinking, as he had been for the last 3 or 4 hours, of that minutes, nay, seconds, aberration of eye or hand which would suffice to precipitate her into the water to be dragged down to death by that senseless millstone which in its turn would not even have to feel agony, he no longer felt any glow of revenge toward her as its custodian. He felt sorry for her, as he would for the living timber in a barn which had to be burned to rid itself of vermin. He paddled on, helping the current, steadily and strongly, with a calculated husbandry of effort, toward what he believed was downstream, towns, people, something to stand upon, while from time to time the woman raised herself to bail the accumulated rain from the skiff. It was raining steadily now, though still not hard, still without passion. The sky, the day itself, dissolving without grief. The skiff moved in a nimbus, an aura of gray gauze which merged almost without demarcation with the roiling, spittle-frothed, debris-choked water. Now the day, the light, definitely began to end, and the convict permitted himself an extra notch or two of effort, because it suddenly seemed to him that the speed of the skiff had lessened. This was actually the case, though the convict did not know it. He merely took it as a phenomenon of the increasing obfuscation, or at most as a result of the long day's continuous effort with no food, complicated by the ebbing and fluxing phases of anxiety and impotent rage at his absolutely gratuitous predicament. So he stepped up his stroke a beat or so, not from alarm, but on the contrary, since he too had received that lift from the mere presence of a known stream, a river known by its ineradicable name to generations of men who had been drawn to live beside it, as man always has been drawn to dwell beside water, even before he had a name for water and fire, drawn to the living water, the course of his destiny and his actual physical appearance rigidly coerced and postulated by it. So he was not alarmed. He paddled on upstream without knowing it, unaware that all the water which for 40 hours now had been pouring through the levee break to the north was somewhere ahead of him on its way back to the river. It was full dark now. That is, night had completely come. The gray dissolving sky had vanished, yet as though in perverse ratio, surface visibility had sharpened, as though the light which the rain of the afternoon had washed out of the air had gathered upon the water as the rain itself had done, so that the yellow flood spread on before him now with a quality almost phosphorescent, right up to the instant where vision ceased. The darkness, in fact, had its advantages. He could now stop seeing the rain. He and his garments had been wet for more than 24 hours now, so he had long since stopped feeling it, and now that he could no longer see it either, it had in a certain sense ceased for him. Also, he now had to make no effort even not to see the swell of his passenger's belly. So he was paddling on, strongly and steadily, not alarmed and not concerned, but just exasperated because he had not yet begun to see any reflection of the clouds which would indicate the city or cities which he believed he was approaching, but which were actually now miles behind him. When he heard a sound, he did not know what it was because he had never heard it before, and he would never be expected to hear such again, since it is not given to every man to hear such at all, and to none to hear it more than once in his life. And he was not alarmed now either, because there was not time, for although the visibility ahead, for all its clarity, did not extend very far, yet in the next instant to the hearing he was also seeing something such as he had never seen before. This was that the sharp line where the phosphorescent water met the darkness was now about 10 feet higher than it had been an instant before, and that it was curled forward upon itself like a sheet of dough being rolled out for a pudding. It reared, stooping. The crest of it swirled like the mane of a galloping horse, and, phosphorescent too, fretted and flickered like fire. And while the woman huddled in the bow, aware or not aware, the convict did not know which, he, the convict, his swollen and blood-streaked face gaped in an expression of aghast and incredulous amazement, continued to paddle directly into it. Again, he simply had not had time to order his rhythm-hypnotized muscles to cease. He continued to paddle, though the skiff had ceased to move forward at all, but seemed to be hanging in space while the paddle still reached, thrust, recovered, and reached again. Now, instead of space, the skiff became abruptly surrounded by a welter of fleeing debris, planks, small buildings, the bodies of drowned yet antic animals, entire trees leaping and diving like porpoises, above which the skiff seemed to hover in weightless and airy indecision, like a bird above a fleeing countryside, undecided where to light or whether to light at all, while the convict squatted in it, still going through the motions of paddling, waiting for an opportunity to scream. He never found it. For an instant the skiff seemed to stand erect on its stern, and then shoot, scrabbling and scrambling up the curling wall of water, like a cat, and soared on above the licking crest itself, and hung, cradled into the high actual air in the limbs of a tree, from which bower of new-leafed boughs and branches the convict, like a bird in its nest, and still waiting his chance to scream, and still going through the motions of paddling, though he no longer even had the paddle now, looked down upon a world turned to furious motion and in incredible retrograde. Sometime about midnight, accompanied by a rolling cannonade of thunder and lightning, like a battery going into action, as though some 40 hours' constipation of the elements, the firmament itself, were discharging in clapping and glaring salute to the ultimate acquiescence to desperate and furious motion, and still leading its charging welter of dead cows and mules and outhouses and cabins and hen coops, the skiff passed Vicksburg. The convict didn't know it. He wasn't looking high enough above the water, who still squatted, clutching the gunwales and glaring at the yellow turmoil about him out of which entire trees, the sharp gables of houses, the long, mournful heads of mules which he fended off with a splintered length of plank snatched from he knew not where in passing, and which seemed to glare reproachfully back at him with sightless eyes in limber-lipped and incredulous amazement, rolled up and then down again, the skiff now traveling forward, now sideways, now sternward, sometimes in the water, sometimes riding for yards upon the roofs of houses and trees, and even upon the backs of the mules, as though even in death they were not to escape that burden-bearing doom with which their eunuch race was cursed. But he didn't see Vicksburg. The skiff, traveling at express speed, was in a seething gut between soaring and dizzy banks, with a glare of light above them, but he did not see it. He saw the flotsam ahead of him divide violently and begin to climb upon itself, mounting, and he was sucked through the resulting gap too fast to recognize it as the trestling of a railroad bridge. For a horrible moment, the skiff seemed to hang in static indecision before the looming flank of a steamboat, as though undecided whether to climb over it or dive under it. Then a hard, icy wind, filled with the smell and taste and sense of wet and boundless desolation, blew upon him. The skiff made one long bounding lunge as the convict's native state, in a final paroxysm, regurgitated him onto the wild bosom of the Father of Waters. This is how he told about it 7 weeks later, sitting in new bed-ticking garments, shaved and with his hair cut again, on his bunk in the barracks. During the next 3 or 4 hours after the thunder and lightning had spent itself, the skiff ran in pitch-streaming darkness upon a roiling expanse, which, even if he could have seen, apparently had no boundaries. Wild and invisible, it tossed and heaved about and beneath the boat, ridged with dirty phosphorescent foam and filled with a debris of destruction. Objects nameless and enormous and invisible which struck and slashed at the skiff and whirled on. He did not know he was now upon the river. At that time he would have refused to believe it, even if he had known. Yesterday he had known he was in a channel by the regularity of the spacing between the bordering trees. Now, since even by daylight he could have seen no boundaries, the last place under the sun, or the streaming sky, rather, he would have suspected himself to be, would have been a river. If he had pondered at all about his present whereabouts, about the geography beneath him, he would merely have taken himself to be traveling at dizzy and inexplicable speed above the largest cotton field in the world. If he who yesterday had known he was in a river had accepted that fact in good faith and earnest, then had seen that river turn without warning and rush back upon him with furious and deadly intent, like a frenzied stallion in a lane, if he had suspected, for 1 second, that the wild and limitless expanse on which he now found himself was a river, consciousness would simply have refused. He would have fainted. When daylight, a gray and ragged dawn filled with driving scud between icy rain squalls, came, and he could see again, he knew he was in no cotton field. He knew that the wild water on which the skiff tossed and fled flowed above no soil tamely trod by man, behind the straining and surging buttocks of a mule. That was when it occurred to him that its present condition was no phenomenon of a decade, but that the intervening years during which it consented to bear upon its placid and sleepy bosom the frail mechanicals of man's clumsy contriving was the phenomenon, and this the norm, and the river was now doing what it liked to do, had waited patiently the 10 years in order to do, as a mule will work for you 10 years for the privilege of kicking you once. And he also learned something else about fear, too, something he had even failed to discover on that other occasion when he was really afraid, that 3 or 4 seconds of that night in his youth, while he looked down the twice-flashing pistol barrel of the terrified mail clerk, before the clerk could be persuaded that his, the convict's, pistol would not shoot, that if you just held on long enough, a time would come in fear after which it would no longer be agony at all, but merely a kind of horrible, outrageous itching, as after you have been burned bad. He did not have to paddle now. He just steered. who had been without food for 24 hours now, and without any sleep to speak of for 50. While the skiff sped on across that boiling desolation where he had long since begun to not dare believe he could possibly be, where he could not doubt he was, trying with his fragment of splintered plank merely to keep the skiff intact and afloat among the houses and trees and dead animals, the entire towns, stores, residences, parks, and farmyards, which leaped and played about him like fish, not trying to reach any destination, just trying to keep the skiff afloat until he did. He wanted so little. He wanted nothing for himself. He just wanted to get rid of the woman, the belly, and he was trying to do that in the right way, not for himself, but for her. He could have put her back into another tree at any time.
"Or you could have jumped out of the boat and let her and it drown," the plump convict said. "Then they could have give you the 10 years for escaping, and then hung you for the murder and charged the boat to your folks."
"Yeah," the tall convict said. But he had not done that. He wanted to do it the right way, find somebody, anybody he could surrender her to, something solid he could set her down on and then jump back into the river, if that would please anyone. That was all he wanted, just to come to something, anything. That didn't seem like a great deal to ask, and he couldn't do it. He told how the skiff fled on.
"Didn't you pass nobody?" the plump convict said. "No steamboat? Nothing?"
"I don't know," the tall one said, while he tried merely to keep it afloat until the darkness thinned and lifted and revealed.
"Darkness," the plump convict said. "I thought you said it was already daylight."
"Yeah," the tall one said. He was rolling a cigarette, pouring the tobacco carefully from a new sack into the creased paper. "This was another one. They had several while I was gone." The skiff to be moving still rapidly up a winding corridor, bordered by drowned trees which the convict recognized again to be a river running again in the direction that, until 2 days ago, had been upstream. He was not exactly warned through instinct that this one, like that of 2 days ago, was in reverse. He would not say that he now believed himself to be in the same river, though he would not have been surprised to find that he did believe this, existing now as he did and had and apparently was to continue for an unnamed period, in a state in which he was toy and pawn on a vicious and inflammable geography. He merely realized that he was in a river again, with all the subsequent inferences of a comprehensible, even if not familiar, portion of the Earth's surface. Now he believed that all he had to do would be to paddle far enough, and he would come to something horizontal and above water, even if not dry, and perhaps even populated. And if fast enough, in time, and that his only other crying urgency was to refrain from looking at the woman, who, as vision, the incontrovertible and apparently inescapable presence of his passenger, returned with dawn, had ceased to be a human being, and, you could add 24 more hours to the first 24 and the first 50 now, even counting the hen. It was dead, drowned, caught by one wing under a shingle on a roof which had rolled momentarily up beside the skiff yesterday, and he had eaten some of it raw, though the woman would not, had become instead one single, inert, monstrous, sentient womb, from which he now believed, if he could only turn his gaze away and keep it away, would disappear, and if he could only keep his gaze from pausing again at the spot it had occupied, would not return. That's what he was doing this time when he discovered the wave was coming. He didn't know how he discovered it was coming back. He heard no sound. It was nothing felt nor seen. He did not even believe that finding the skiff to be now in slack water, that is, that the motion of the current, which, whether right or wrong, had at least been horizontal, had now stopped that and assumed a vertical direction, was sufficient to warn him. Perhaps it was just an invincible and almost fanatic faith in the inventiveness and innate viciousness of that medium on which his destiny was now cast, apparently forever. A sudden conviction, far beyond either horror or surprise, that now was none too soon for it to prepare to do whatever it was it intended doing. So he whirled the skiff, spun it on its heel like a running horse, whereupon, reversed, he could not even distinguish the very channel he had come up. He did not know whether he simply could not see it, or if it had vanished some time ago, and he not aware at the time, whether the river had become lost in a drowned world, or if the world had become drowned in one limitless river. So now he could not tell if he were running directly before the wave, or quartering across its line of charge. All he could do was keep that sense of swiftly accumulating ferocity behind him, and paddle as fast as his spent and now numb muscles could be driven, and try not to look at the woman, to wrench his gaze from her and keep it away until he reached something flat and above water. So, gaunt, hollow-eyed, striving and wrenching almost physically at his eyes as if they were two of those suction-tipped rubber arrows shot from the toy gun of a child, his spent muscles obeying not will now, but that attenuation beyond mere exhaustion, which, mesmeric, can continue easier than cease. He once more drove the skiff full tilt into something it could not pass, and, once more, hurled violently forward onto his hands and knees, crouching. He glared with his wild, swollen face up at the man with the shotgun, and said in a harsh, croaking voice, "Vicksburg! Where's Vicksburg?" Even when he tried to tell it, even after the 7 weeks, and he, safe, secure, riveted, warranted and doubly guaranteed by the 10 years they had added to his sentence for attempted escape, something of the old hysteric, incredulous outrage came back into his face, his voice, his speech. He never did even get on the other boat. He told how he clung to a strake. It was a dirty, unpainted shanty boat with a drunken rake of tin stovepipe. It had been moving when he struck it, and apparently it had not even changed course, even though the 3 people on it must have been watching him all the while. A second man, barefoot and with matted hair and beard, also at the steering sweep. And then, he did not know how long, a woman leaning in the door, in a filthy assortment of men's garments, watching him too with the same cold speculation. Being dragged violently along, trying to state and explain his simple and, to him at least, reasonable desire and need. Telling it, trying to tell it. He could feel again the old unforgettable affronting like an ague fit as he watched the abortive tobacco rain steadily and faintly from between his shaking hands. And then the paper itself part with a thin, dry, snapping report. "Burn my clothes," the convict cried. "Burn them?" "How in the hell do you expect to escape in them billboards?" the man with the shotgun said. He, the convict, tried to tell it, tried to explain as he had tried to explain not to the 3 people on the boat alone, but to the entire circumambience. Desolate water and forlorn trees and sky. Not for justification, because he needed none, and knew that his hearers, the other convicts, required none from him, but rather, as on the point of exhaustion, he might have picked dreamily and incredulously at a suffocation. He told the man with the gun how he and his partner had been given the boat, and told to pick up a man and a woman, how he had lost his partner and failed to find the man, and now all in the world he wanted was something flat to leave the woman on until he could find an officer, a sheriff. He thought of home, the place where he had lived almost since childhood, his friends of years whose ways he knew and who knew his ways, the familiar fields where he did work he had learned to do well and to like, the mules with characters he knew and respected as he knew and respected the characters of certain men. He thought of the barracks at night, with screens against the bugs in summer and good stoves in winter, and someone to supply the fuel and the food, too. The Sunday ball games and the picture shows, things which, with the exception of the ball games, he had never known before. But most of all, his own character. 2 years ago they had offered to make a trustee of him. He would no longer need to plow or feed stock. He would only follow those who did with a loaded gun. But he declined. "I reckon I'll stick to plowing," he said, absolutely without humor. "I done already tried to use a gun one time too many." His good name, his responsibility, not only toward those who were responsible toward him, but to himself. His own honor in the doing of what was asked of him, his pride in being able to do it, no matter what it was. He thought of this and listened to the man with the gun talking about escape, and it seemed to him that, hanging there, being dragged violently along, it was here, he said, that he first noticed the goat's beards of moss in the trees, though it could have been there for several days, so far as he knew. It just happened that he first noticed it here, that he would simply burst. "Can't you get it into your head that the last thing I want to do is run away?" he cried. "You can sit there with that gun and watch me. I give you fair leaf. All I want is to put this woman—" "And I told you she could come aboard," the man with the gun said in his level voice. "But there ain't no room on no boat of mine for nobody hunting a sheriff in no kind of clothes, let alone a penitentiary suit." "When he steps aboard, knock him in the head with the gun barrel," the man at the sweep said. "He's drunk." "He ain't coming aboard," the man with the gun said. "He's crazy." Then the woman spoke. She didn't move, leaning in the door in a pair of faded and patched and filthy overalls like the two men. "Give them some grub and tell them to get out of here." She moved. She crossed the deck and looked down at the convict's companion with her cold, sullen face. "How much more time have you got?" "It wasn't due till next month," the woman in the boat said. "But I—" The woman in overalls turned to the man with the gun. "Give them some grub," she said. But the man with the gun was still looking down at the woman in the boat. "Come on," he said to the convict. "Put her aboard and beat it." "And what'll happen to you," the woman in overalls said, "when you try to turn her over to an officer, when you lay alongside a sheriff and the sheriff asks you who you are?" Still, the man with the gun didn't even look at her. He hardly even shifted the gun across his arm as he struck the woman across the face with the back of his other hand, hard. "You son of a bitch," she said. Still, the man with the gun did not even look at her. "Well," he said to the convict. "Don't you see I can't?" the convict cried. "Can't you see that?" "Now," he said, he gave up. He was doomed. That is, he knew now that he had been doomed from the very start never to get rid of her, just as the ones who sent him out with the skiff knew that he never would actually give up. When he recognized one of the objects which the woman in overalls was hurling into the skiff to be a can of condensed milk, he believed it to be a presage, gratuitous and irrevocable as a death notice over the telegraph, that he was not even to find a flat, stationary surface in time for the child to be born on it. So he told how he held the skiff alongside the shanty boat while the first tentative toying of the second wave made up beneath him, while the woman in overalls passed back and forth between house and rail, flinging the food, the hunk of salt meat, the ragged and filthy quilt, the scorched lumps of cold bread which she poured into the skiff from a heaped dishpan like so much garbage. while he clung to the strake against the mounting pull of the current. The new wave, which for the moment he had forgotten, because he was still trying to state the incredible simplicity of his desire and need, until the man with the gun, the only one of the three who wore shoes, began to stamp at his hands. He, snatching his hands away one at a time to avoid the heavy shoes, then grasping the rail again, until the man with the gun kicked at his face. He flinging himself sideways to avoid the shoe, and so breaking his hold on the rail, his weight canting the skiff off at a tangent on the increasing current, so that it began to leave the shanty boat behind, and he paddling again now, violently, as a man hurries toward the precipice for which he knows at last he is doomed, looking back at the other boat, the three faces sullen, derisive, and grim, and rapidly diminishing across the widening water, and at last apoplectic, suffocating with the intolerable fact not that he had been refused, but that he had been refused so little, had wanted so little, asked for so little, yet there had been demanded of him in return the one price out of all breath, which, they must have known, if he could have paid it, he would not have been where he was. Asking what he asked, raising the paddle and shaking it and screaming curses back at them even after the shotgun flashed and the charge went scuttering past along the water to one side. So he hung there, he said, shaking the paddle and howling, when suddenly he remembered that other wave, the second wall of water full of houses and dead mules building up behind him back in the swamp. So he quit yelling then and went back to paddling. He was not trying to outrun it. He just knew from experience that when it overtook him, he would have to travel in the same direction it was moving in anyway, whether he wanted to or not. And when it did overtake him, he would begin to move too fast to stop, no matter what places he might come to where he could leave the woman, land her in time. Time. That was his itch now. So his only chance was to stay ahead of it as long as he could and hope to reach something before it struck. So he went on, driving the skiff with muscles which had been too tired so long they had quit feeling it, as when a man has had bad luck for so long that he ceases to believe it is even bad, let alone luck. Even when he ate, the scorched lumps the size of baseballs and the weight and durability of cannel coal, even after having lain in the skiff's bilge where the shanty boatwoman had thrown them, the iron-like, lead-heavy objects which no man would have called bread outside of the crusted and scorched pan in which they had cooked. It was with one hand, begrudging even that from the paddle. He tried to tell that, too. That day while the skiff fled on among the bearded trees, while every now and then small, quiet, tentative, exploratory feelers would come up from the wave behind and toy for a moment at the skiff, light and curious, then go on with a faint hissing, sighing, almost a chuckling sound, the skiff going on, driving on with nothing to see but trees and water and solitude. Until after a while it no longer seemed to him that he was trying to put space and distance behind him, or shorten space and distance ahead, but that both he and the wave were now hanging, suspended, simultaneous and unprogressing in pure time, upon a dreamy desolation in which he paddled on not from any hope even to reach anything at all, but merely to keep intact what little of distance the length of the skiff provided between himself and the inert and inescapable mass of female meat before him. Then night and the skiff rushing on, fast, since any speed over anything unknown and invisible is too fast, with nothing before him, and behind him the outrageous idea of a volume of moving water toppling forward, its crest frothed and shredded like fangs. And then dawn again. Another of those dreamlike alterations, day to dark, then back to day again, with that quality truncated, anachronic, and unreal as the waxing and waning of lights in a theater scene. And the skiff emerging now, with the woman no longer supine beneath the shrunken, soaked private's coat, but sitting bolt upright, gripping the gunwales with both hands, her eyes closed and her lower lip caught between her teeth, and he driving the splintered board furiously now, glaring at her out of his wild, swollen, sleepless face and crying, croaking, "Hold on! For God's sake, hold on!" "I'm trying to," she said, "but hurry, hurry." He told it the unbelievable. Hurry, hasten. The man falling from a cliff being told to catch on to something and save himself. The very telling of it emerging shadowy and burlesque, ludicrous, comic, and mad, from the ague of unbearable forgetting with a quality more dreamily furious than any fable behind proscenium lights. He was in a basin now. "A basin," the plump convict said. "That's what you wash in." "All right," the tall one said, harshly, above his hands. "I did." With a supreme effort, he stilled them long enough to release the two bits of cigarette paper and watched them waft in light, fluttering indecision, to the floor between his feet, holding his hands motionless even for a moment longer. A basin, a broad, peaceful yellow sea which had an abruptly and curiously ordered air, giving him even at that moment the impression that it was accustomed to water, even if not total submersion. He even remembered the name of it, told to him 2 or 3 weeks later by someone. Atchafalaya. "Louisiana," the plump convict said. "You mean you were clean out of Mississippi? Hellfire." He stared at the tall one. "Shucks," he said. "That ain't but just across from Vicksburg." "They never named any Vicksburg across from where I was," the tall one said. "It was Baton Rouge they named." And now he began to talk about a town, a little neat white portrait town nestling among enormous, very green trees, appearing suddenly in the telling as it probably appeared in actuality, abrupt and airy and mirage-like, and incredibly serene before him, behind a scattering of boats moored to a line of freight cars standing flush to the doors in water. And now he tried to tell that, too. How he stood waist-deep in water for a moment, looking back and down at the skiff in which the woman half lay, her eyes still closed, her knuckles white on the gunwales, and a tiny thread of blood creeping down her chin from her chewed lip, and he looking down at her in a kind of furious desperation.
"How far will I have to walk?" she said.
"I don't know, I tell you," he cried. "But it's land somewhere yonder. It's land, houses."
"If I try to move, it won't even be borne inside a boat," she said. "You'll have to get closer."
"Yes," he cried, wild, desperate, incredulous. "Wait, I'll go and surrender. Then they will have—" He didn't finish, wait to finish. He told that, too, himself splashing, stumbling, trying to run, sobbing and gasping. Now he saw it, another loading platform standing above the yellow flood, the khaki figures on it as before, identical, the same. He said how the intervening days since that first innocent morning telescoped, vanished as if they had never been, the two contiguous succeeding instants, succeeding, simultaneous. And he, transported across no intervening space, but merely turned in his own footsteps, plunging, splashing, his arms raised, croaking harshly. He heard the startled shout. "There's one of them!" The command, the clash of equipment, the alarmed cry. "There he goes! There he goes!" "Yes," he cried, running, plunging. "Here I am! Here! Here!" Running on into the first scattered volley, stopping among the bullets, waving his arms, shrieking,
I want to surrender! I want to surrender!
Watching, not in terror, but in amazed and absolutely unbearable outrage, as a squatting clump of the khaki figures parted, and he saw the machine gun. The blunt, thick muzzle slant and drop and probe toward him, and he, still screaming in his hoarse crow's voice,
I want to surrender! Can't you hear me?
Continuing to scream, even as he whirled and plunged, splashing, ducking, went completely under and heard the bullets going thuck, thuck, thuck on the water above him, and he, scrambling still on the bottom, still trying to scream even before he regained his feet, and still all submerged save his plunging, unmistakable buttocks, the outraged screaming bubbling from his mouth and about his face, since he merely wanted to surrender. Then he was comparatively screened, out of range, though not for long. That is, he didn't tell how nor where. There was a moment in which he paused, breathed for a second before running again. The course back to the skiff open for the time being, though he could still hear the shouts behind him, and now and then a shot. And he panting, sobbing, a long savage tear in the flesh of one hand, got when and how he did not know. And he, wasting precious breath, speaking to no one now any more than the scream of the dying rabbit is addressed to any mortal ear, but rather an indictment of all breath and its folly and suffering, its infinite capacity for folly and pain, which seems to be its only immortality. All in the world I want is just to surrender. He returned to the skiff and got in and took up his splintered plank. And now, when he told this, despite the fury of element which climaxed it, it, the telling, became quite simple. He now even creased another cigarette paper between fingers which did not tremble at all, and filled the paper from the tobacco sack without spilling a flake, as though he had passed from the machine gun's barrage into a bourne beyond any more amazement, so that the subsequent part of his narrative seemed to reach his listeners as though from beyond a sheet of slightly milky, though still transparent, glass, as something not heard, but seen, a series of shadows, edgeless yet distinct, and smoothly flowing, logical and unfrantic, and making no sound. They were in the skiff, in the center of the broad, placid trough which had no boundaries, and down which the tiny, forlorn skiff flew to the irresistible coercion of a current going once more he knew not where. The neat, small, live-oak-bowered towns unattainable and mirage-like, and apparently attached to nothing upon the airy and unchanging horizon. He did not believe them. They did not matter. He was doomed. They were less than the figments of smoke or of delirium. And he, driving his unceasing paddle without destination or even hope now, looking now and then at the woman sitting with her knees drawn up and locked and her entire body one terrific clench while the threads of bloody saliva crept from her teeth-clenched lower lip. He was going nowhere and fleeing from nothing. He merely continued to paddle because he had paddled so long now that he believed if he stopped, his muscles would scream in agony. So when it happened, he was not surprised. He heard the sound which he knew well. He had heard it but once before, true enough, but no man needed to hear it but once. And he had been expecting it. He looked back, still driving the paddle, and saw it, curled, crested with its straw-like flotsam of trees and debris and dead beasts, and he glared over his shoulder at it for a full minute, out of that attenuation far beyond the point of outragement, where even suffering, the capability of being further affronted, had ceased, from which he now contemplated with savage and invulnerable curiosity the further extent to which his now anesthetized nerves could bear, what next could be invented for them to bear.
until the wave actually began to rear above his head into its thunderous climax. Then only did he turn his head. His stroke did not falter. It neither slowed nor increased. Still paddling with that spent hypnotic steadiness, he saw the swimming deer. He did not know what it was, nor that he had altered the skiff's course to follow it. He just watched the swimming head before him as the wave boiled down and the skiff rose bodily in the old familiar fashion on a welter of tossing trees and houses and bridges and fences. He, still paddling even while the paddle found no purchase save air, and still paddled even as he and the deer shot forward side by side at arm's length. He watching the deer now, watching the deer begin to rise out of the water bodily until it was actually running along upon the surface, rising still, soaring clear of the water altogether, vanishing upward in a dying crescendo of splashings and snapping branches, its damp scut flashing upward, the entire animal vanishing upward as smoke vanishes. And now the skiff struck and canted, and he was out of it too, standing knee-deep, springing out and falling to his knees, scrambling up, glaring after the vanished deer.
"Land!" he croaked. "Land! Hold on! Just hold on!"
He caught the woman beneath the arms, dragging her out of the boat, plunging and panting after the vanished deer. Now earth actually appeared, an acclivity smooth and swift and steep, bizarre, solid, and unbelievable. An Indian mound, and he plunging at the muddy slope, slipping back, the woman struggling in his muddy hands.
"Let me down," she cried. "Let me down."
But he held her, panting, sobbing, and rushed again at the muddy slope. He had almost reached the flat crest with his now violently unmanageable burden when a stick under his foot gathered itself with thick, convulsive speed. It was a snake, he thought, as his feet fled beneath him, and with the indubitable last of his strength, he half pushed and half flung the woman up the bank. As he shot feet first and face down, back into that medium upon which he had lived for more days and nights than he could remember, and from which he himself had never completely emerged, as if his own failed and spent flesh were attempting to carry out his furious, unflagging will for severance at any price, even that of drowning, from the burden with which, unwitting and without choice, he had been doomed. Later, it seemed to him that he had carried back beneath the surface with him the sound of the infant's first mewling cry.